Can you hear me? I put you on speaker.
I can hear you.
Okay, good. I'm hoping that it's recording. Okay, so we're in Derech Hashem, and I believe that we are in the Soul Inspiration Prophecy, which is section 3, chapter 1 of section 3, in the 6th paragraph. And is that where you're holding? If it's just the two of us right now, we can go to where you're.
I'm holding with whatever you are up to.
Okay. So the last time we talked about the levels of the soul, so just real quickly you could bring us to the levels of the soul that's divided into five parts: the nefesh, the ruach, the neshama, the chaya, and the yechida, and that different parts come and go at different times, which hopefully we'll talk about more at length. And that we also have an neshama yateira that comes on Shabbos, and a separate type of neshama yateira that comes on Yontif. I think we discussed that also, which is why after Yontif we don't smell spices, and after Shabbos we do, because that neshama yateira after Yontif stays, and that becomes permanently incorporated, and the neshama yateira for Shabbos comes and goes, and helps us achieve a spiritual level while we have it, but doesn't stay as a kli for after, whereas with Yontif it stays as a kli. Okay, so now paragraph 5. The divine soul on the level of neshama also has experiences relating to its nature. Even though it's bound to the body, it still has some access to the spiritual, which is not precluded by its association with the body. The spiritual associations of the neshama, however, have only a minimal effect on the human mind and its thoughts. Our sages thus teach us, even though a person does not see something, his destiny or his mazal sees it. What this means is that matters of the higher world, the spiritual realms, do reach the divine soul, but they do not reach man's thoughts and intellect, so that the body's reaction and awareness of them is next to nil. Okay, so let's now look back at those five levels of the soul. The nefesh, we said, is the part that rests up against the edges of our body, so to speak. It's that part that's connected to our blood, that part that's our animating life force, keeps us alive. So we have the animal nefesh, and then we have the lowest level of our human soul called the nefesh, and they're attached to each other and then attached to the blood, to our body. So the nefesh is what really does keep our body going. And then we have been skipping the ruach level. We have the neshama, which is where our spiritual aspirations are. That's the part where we have she'ifas and spiritual desires to go places, do things, connect to Hashem. In between those two levels, level 1 and 3, is the ruach, which is the wind, the spirit, the mediating force. It's a dynamic force that moves back and forth between those two, bringing, in a way, the inspiration of the neshama into the nefesh and bringing the body's energy of the nefesh up to the neshama, going back and forth, back and forth. That's what the ruach's job is, to see that constant mediating force, back and forth between the more physical parts of us and the more spiritual parts. Excuse me. Then we have the upper two levels, the chaya and the yechida. Those two parts we really don't feel pretty much at all. But the neshama itself is a bridge piece of the neshama. The neshama chunk of the neshama whole is a bridge piece that is both slightly connected and also not connected. So that's what this is saying here, that the spiritual associations of the neshama level only have a minimal effect. So they do have an effect, but only a minimal effect on the human mind and its thoughts. So it is what's able to reach some higher realms, but it also does touch our thoughts, or things can filter through it to touch our thoughts and mind. Okay, let's look deeper into how this works. So any questions on that so far? Should I go to number 6?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, number 6. The highest wisdom deemed it appropriate to divide the day into two parts, one for activity and the other for rest. The daily cycle is thus divided into day and night, day being the time of activity and night the time of rest. God also gave living creatures a nature, causing them to sleep, so that both they and their spirits should rest from the normal activity. At that time, their strength is renewed, both physically and spiritually, and they awake in the morning, again ready for their daily tasks. Now, let me just add a physical piece in here. We're talking about all this metaphysical, but the fascinating physical piece that's important to know as a mom and as a Makarevit and as an active person in the world, that obviously we need our rest, but we often hit a second wind. But what is that second wind? The second wind is the extra burst of energy that we get at night that allows us to do something extra, right? That second wind, what we call the second wind, is really supposed to be released while we're sleeping. And it's that physical burst of energy, that extra bit of energy, that is the energy that is drawn upon for cellular repair and body fixing up. So it's very important to go to sleep before your second wind, because you need that in order to heal. So in case you're able to do that, go to sleep before you tap into your second wind. I know it sounds impossible, but it really is important, because that second wind, which we use occasionally, it should be kept occasional, because that really is your, if you're constantly going into that, you're constantly running on empty.
Mm-hmm.
That really is a very important energy that needs to go inside instead of outside. Okay, so we have a nature that causes us to sleep. So we could ask, what's the point of that? Why does God make us sleep? And he didn't have to arrange it for us that way. But it's interesting, some of the mystical things that happen with that. So let's just look. When man sleeps, his faculties rest. His senses are quiet, and his mind is relaxed and hushed. The only thing that continues to function is his imagination. And this conceives and envisions various images. Some of these images arrive from the individual's experiences while awake. Others may be the result of substances that rise to the brain from food or from the body itself. Such are the stimuli for normal dreams, those which are experienced by everyone. So we have this restful time when our senses are quiet, but our minds are still working. So what is our mind working on? Some of it's processing what? Some of it is just processing what happened during the day, and some of it is triggered by what we ate or what we experienced or what's going on inside of our body. So that's basically what goes into our dreams. Right, those are regular dreams. That's the ingredients of regular dreams. However, God also decreed that the bond between the body and the divine soul should be somewhat loosened while man sleeps. This is why our sages tell us that sleep is 1/60th of death.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we have in the Gemara, and I'm not sure which Gemara it's in, but in the Gemara it talks about the 1/60th number. And we certainly talk about that in Kashrus, something is batal b'shishim, right? So if something is batal b'shishim, nullified in 1/60th, and if it's 1/60th or less, it can be nullified within the total. So it means that that amount is a real amount. You can tell, like if you have 60 coins of Hanukkah gelt, right? You can clearly see what 1/60th is. It's a piece that you can hold and you can tell from the group. But it's a small piece of the whole. So it's a piece that could be nullified in it. So if you have that amount, you can have 1 teaspoon of milk and a whole pot of chicken soup because by mistake you were stirring the hot chocolate on a winter day and you stuck that spoon into chicken soup. So your chicken soup is still kosher with that amount of actual milk in it because it's batal b'shishim. But it's still that amount that's on the spoon. It was a real amount. You could taste that milk if you would have licked the spoon. You would have had to make a breath on it, right? So it's a real amount. So when we say 1/60th of something, we're talking about an amount that's real but that is small. So when we say that sleep is 1/60th of death, we are talking about a real amount but a small amount. We have the 1/60th measurement also with when we visit sick people, when we are mevaka kolim, we take away 1/60th of their illness. So that's a real amount, but it's a small amount. You can't really tell. You know, you can't see the extra health in the person after you leave, but that is what we're told. So how is this 1/60th of death? What about sleep is like death? So this is, now we're going to see the answer to that question. The portions of the soul from ruach, spirit, and above, then rise and sever themselves from the body. Only one portion, the nefesh, remains with the lower animal soul. Okay, so if we define death, and as Jews, this is one of our definitions of death, is the soul's departure from the body. That's when somebody dies, when the soul leaves the body. Then, if most of the soul leaves the body while one is sleeping, then we could say that sleep is like a little bit of death. It's a brush of death. And interestingly, it's for this reason that we're very makbid and negelvasser in the morning. Because when the soul comes back after we wake up, we have had a brush of death energy, of the soul leaving us. And we're going to see further. I guess I'll go into that further. Let's just keep looking. The freed portions of the soul can then move about in the spiritual realm wherever they are allowed. They can interact and associate with such spiritual beings as the angels who oversee natural phenomena, some angels associated with prophecy, and pagans. What the freed part of a person's soul actually will experience while the person sleeps will depend on a variety of factors. So there's all kinds of different things that can happen when those souls are loosened and float around in the spiritual realms while we sleep. They can experience quite a bit, from good to bad, and many things in between. They can touch prophecy. There's all kinds of things they can learn and bring back. When these higher levels of the soul perceive something, they can sometimes transmit it, not always, sometimes transmit it step by step until it reaches the animal soul. The imagination is then stimulated and forms images in its normal manner. And then a person can see this as a dream. The things perceived by the higher soul, however, may be true or false depending on the means through which they are experienced. The concept itself is then transmitted to the imagination and depicted in a normal fashion as in any other dream. Sometimes this information is greatly confused and intermingled with distorted images arising from the various substances that enter the brain, while at other times the information is received very clearly. Okay, so let's go back a little bit. So imagine these soul levels. Right? So you can see them like links in a chain, five links, one on top of the other. The upper four links can loosen and detach while somebody's sleeping. It's just the bottom one, the nefesh, that stays attached, that keeps you alive. But the upper four can all loosen their bonds and travel in the spiritual realms while one is asleep. The way that that works, a way to understand that working is that a way that I explain it is sort of like kite string. They're like kites flying, still attached. So like if you imagine a child's hand holding the string of a kite, like once the kite starts to fly, it can let the string out further and further and further, and it can go higher and higher and higher, but it is still connected to the ground through the child that's holding it. So while those parts of the neshama, the bonds are loosened and they can travel, they're loosened between the body and the soul, they can travel around, still they are connected, because if they would be completely disconnected, that's what we call death. And this is just sleep. So there still is a connection, sort of like, just imagining, a kite string where they float around into different realms. But it's not just how far they can go, the distance of the string that the child has let out, or the distance that the soul is permitted to travel. But it needs a second thing as well, and so my muscle for that is a visa. Each chunk of soul not only needs the kite string so that it can go where to a far place, but it also needs a visa to get into that far place or to have the conversation with whatever spiritual being it might encounter. It doesn't have the privilege. Not every soul has the privilege to encounter or be in relationship with every spiritual being that's around. So, and that's what it's saying here. Let's see. Right, what the freed parts of a person's soul actually will experience while a person sleeps will depend on a variety of factors. We'll look at some of those factors. But there are a variety of factors that influence what a freed part of a person's soul can come into contact with. Not discussing those factors yet, but just that they have gone somewhere and experienced something. Let's just start with that. Those loosened chunks of soul have gone somewhere and experienced something. Then, depending on which level experiences, let's just say it was the yechida, the highest level that experienced something, The Yechida can then transmit that information or knowledge down to the Chaya. The Chaya can then transmit it down to the Neshama. The Neshama transmits it down to the Ruach down to the Nefesh down to the imagination, and then the imagination conjures up a dream in the usual manner that the imagination conjures dreams. Sometimes that information that came from a high place is just mixed into dream stuff and you have no clue. It's just something weird that's in your dream. And sometimes it's a very clear dream, almost through a HaKodesh, that comes through. But it's always mixed. Even if it's something that's a very clear revelation, it's always mixed with other stuff. Just the question is, how much is it mixed? So looking back down at this paragraph, I'll just reread this so you can understand that again. Sometimes this information is greatly confused and intermingled with distorted images arising from the various substances that enter the brain, while at other times the information is received very clearly. Any questions before I finish? It's a long piece here.
No.
Okay. A person can sometimes receive information and knowledge about his future in this manner. This occurs as a result of God's decree. The information is then revealed to the soul, to the neshama, by one of God's servants, of whatever type it might be. It is then transmitted down to the nefesh and visualized by the imagination, either clearly or obscurely, as decreed by the highest wisdom. Regarding such dreams, the scriptures say in Eov, in a dream, in a vision of the night, Hashem opens the ears of man. Right, b'chalom chazion laila, az yigale ozen anashim. Right, that Hashem reveals into their ears. Dreams in general can therefore arise either from the imagination itself, or as a result of the stimulation of the soul, according to what it perceives. In the latter case, the initiating agent is always one of the spiritual forces, which makes something known to the neshama. The soul then transmits this to the imagination in the manner described above. If that spiritual force is one of God's holy servants, then the information that the soul receives will be true. If it comes from the opposing forces, on the other hand, then it will be false. Our sages thus teach us that a true dream originates through a malach, while a false one originates through a shade. All dreams, however, are intermingled with the distorted images originating in the imagination itself. Our sages thus teach us, it is impossible to have a dream that does not contain worthless information. There is an entirely different category of dreams, however, which involve true prophecy, and these will be discussed in a separate section. So we're not going there, but these are what we're discussing now is the kind of dreams that we have that aren't prophecy. Aren't prophetic. They may have Ruach HaKodesh in them, but they're not prophecy. Mm-hmm. So there's two different forces, two of the forces that could have influence on our neshama while its bond is loosened from our body are malachim, forces of Kedusha, and the opposite, negative forces that could be giving us false information. Both sets of information, however, provided by an emissary of Hashem. So Hashem allows the negative forces to provide information when that's what we deserve, in a sense. Well, now let's look a little bit at what's going on while we sleep. We have a few factors. So one is the loosening of the bonds of our soul. And another is the energy of nighttime. So nighttime, darkness, is a mushel. Darkness is a mushel for the absence of light, right? So light is a mushel for what's good in the world, and darkness is a mushel for what's bad in the world. So, but even physically, it's still a mushel, so even when it actually exists. So in the time of darkness, it is a time of danger. It is a time when not only is there the physical danger from not being able to see where you're going or people being able to hide more easily, but things are more confused. That's why evening is called Erev. Erev means mixed up. The arbev is to stir, to mix something in modern Hebrew. Yerbuvia is a confusion. And Erev is a mixing. So at nighttime, things are mixed around. And the morning, Boker, is when things are clear. A Bikorit is a test where you're clarifying things. Right? To be Mavaker Holim is not really to visit them, but rather to inspect them, to make sure that they have what they need, that their home is clean, their dishes are washed, their clothes are laundered, you know, they have the food that they need, the medical care that they need. Really, that's what we're supposed to be doing when we're Mavaker Holim, is to check them out, make sure they have what they need. So Boker is from Bikorit, to check out, to see clearly, and Erev is from mixing up confusion. So at night, we have confusion, and we have lack of clarity, and Hashem also made it so that the negative forces have a stronger influence at night, which is why nighttime is for sleeping. We're not really supposed to be up at night. There's a machloket among our sages if night is for sleep or night is for learning. But clearly it's for one or the other and not for other things. So night's not for Facebook, and it's not for novels, and it's not for, you know, whatever other stuff. Probably not. I mean, we have to figure out our own levels and where we're holding, but it's really, nighttime is for sleeping. Nighttime is a time when we require extra protection, and we don't want to be putting ourselves out in an unprotected zone in an unprotected time. So, okay, so now let's say we've taken the step of going to sleep, actually, at night. And I still feel like, personally, I feel like a toddler at night, because really inside myself, even when my grown-up self says, okay, it's time for bed, my inside self says, no, 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 I don't want to go to sleep. Even when my body is saying, I want to go to sleep, my inside is saying, is just stamping and saying, I don't want to. I have so much to do. Don't make me shut down for the night. But still, let's say we've actually taken that step and we have gone to sleep. So now what's happening? So we are more protected from the negative forces that reign outside. And certainly, you know, at nighttime is when we're more scared of I don't know, being attacked or thievery, that kind of thing. So we're protected from that while we're sleeping, but still we're sleeping at night. And the sleeping at night is a time when the negative forces are more active. And so they are even more active around us. They can settle down on us while we sleep. So not only do we have the negative forces around us and able to settle on us while we sleep, but we have the loosening of the bonds of our soul so that really our spiritual innards have loosened and left. So we're more spiritually vulnerable while we're sleeping. So we have the forces of night. We have the quiet, we have the sleep, and we have the loosened bonds of our soul so that we're more able to be makabel tuma at night. Mm-hmm. Right? The negative forces are there, and they are able to attach themselves to us. Now, what protects us from that attachment, or what makes us extra vulnerable to that attachment? And the answer is what we have done during the day before, how we lived our life during the day. How we were careful with our Shmiras HaLashon, how we behaved, what our tznius level was like, what we ate, how we benched, how we our kavanas and everything, the chesed that we did. However we used our physical body and allowed our soul to have influence over us during the day, that creates a level of protection or, the converse, a level of vulnerability for that night's experience. And I'm not positive, but I believe that there's a cumulative effect over the many days and what that causes, and then that there's also the specific effect of that day, that those two forces work together, both cumulative and direct. So that each night we have a level of vulnerability or protection, and that also is what influences how far the kite string can go and what visas our neshama levels have when they're traveling. So that's really that. What we do during the day is what influences the destination that our soul can go to, the levels that our soul can attend to, and the level of vulnerability that our body that's left behind experiences. Does that all make sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay, I know it's a lot, right? So what happens when we wake up? When we wake up, our soul comes back into us. And it's interesting to think about. Sometimes in order to help us wake up, we need to eat something or drink something. That really, in a way, food is the thread that bonds body and soul together. And which is why, let's say, on a fast day, it's harder to think, harder to function, because there is a little bit of disconnect between body and soul. And if you go without food and drink long enough, body and soul completely separate, right, and causes death. Mm-hmm. But eating something can help bring your soul back in, like lock it back into place. But meanwhile, when we wake up, our soul does come back. Once our soul comes back, there's still all that tuma that was on our body, both from the absence of whatever level of soul left and because of the level of vulnerability that we had and whatever was around, whatever forces of negativity were able to rest on us while we slept. For both of those reasons, there's a tuma. By divine decree, I'm sure this has got to be somewhere else in Derech Hashem because there's a lot of information that I'm giving you, but it is actually all in the text somewhere. By divine decree, all of that tuma concentrates in our fingertips once we wake up. So it all goes from everywhere in our body all down into our fingertips, which is why we're very careful not to touch our fingertips to any opening of our body before we do Negelwasser. Mm-hmm. Why we're careful to not reuse the water of Negelwasser. You know, if we're washing hands for bread, let's say we, you know, have to schlep water from a well, and we have minimal water, and it's not easy to get it. We could wash our hands for bread and use that to water a plant or feed an animal. But when we're washing our hands Negelwasser, that water is toxic, and that water we don't use for anything else. So that goes, that all has to go straight to waste, I know, down the sink if we're lucky enough to have one, and otherwise into a place that it can't be used by other things because it's very toxic water. So we're careful to wash our hands to wash away. And it's a special kind of washing, different than washing for bread or other tumas. It's the same kind of washing we do when leaving a cemetery because we do have an energy. We have a concentrated death energy on the edges of our fingers when we wake up from sleep. So particularly in the morning when we wake up from a night sleep, a long sleep and a nighttime sleep, the tuma is very strong. But even because our souls can, the levels of our soul can be loosened even during a nap. We also have the custom, although it's not as strong, but many people have do have a custom if we sleep for more than half an hour, even during the day, to wash for whatever level of tuma is there because our soul floated, was loosened a little bit. So there still is a death energy that comes with a longer sleep where the soul, or the, not just a nodding off, but where the bonds of the soul can be loosened a long enough sleep that allows that to happen. There still would be a tuma that comes and then is concentrated by divine decree in the fingertips and then can be washed away with water. So that's why even with little children, there are those who are accustomed to be very careful in Negelwasser. I'm not exactly sure what the halachas are, all the different minhagim of when to start, but I do know that some people are careful even from birth. There is a thought that care in Negelwasser can ensure or help facilitate an on-time bris. And with the baby, of course, they're sleeping all the time. You don't wash every time they wake up. But in the morning, their main morning wake up, some people would be careful to even wash a baby's hands. But certainly a mother's hands and a mother, even who's nursing at night, would be well advised to wash even in the middle of the night. So they wouldn't be touching any orifice, not theirs and not their child's, with the hands that have that kind of tuma from sleeping. Any questions on that?
No.
No.
I was actually told that middle of the night, I don't have to, like, to nurse the baby, I don't have to wash my glasses.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
So go by, you know, how you learn. I asked about it, and I was told that I should, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, because I wasn't told it's a must. I was told it's a very strong recommendation, if you can.
Right. Uh-huh.
So, but each person has to go. I mean, you know, this is not a halacha. This is really a behavior that stems from a hashkafa.
Mm-hmm.
So with hashkafa, where there could, I mean, elu ve'elu really applies, even sometimes applies with halacha, but for sure with hashkafa, there could be different opinions that even oppose each other, and they could both be right. And it's a
mm-hmm.
super tricky thing with hashkafa. And we're going to find out, you know, in the end of time. And we don't know for a fact that all of this is right. You know, this is most of the Ramchal's information is Kabbalah. And, you know, he explains it in a way that's relatively easy for us to understand. But this is a Kabbalistic theory of how it all works.
Mm-hmm.
And much of it received from places, whether it's spiritual places or sages or straight from Sinai, all mixed together. The reason why we learn it is for it to impact on our lives today. We don't just need to learn about soul levels so that we can be curious about soul levels. We want to learn about it so that we know, wow, our souls are actually real, and they really are influenced by what we do. What we do influences the soul and where they can go and what they can gain, and then what they gain influences us in our physical lives. So these are all real concepts. That's the point of learning this, is not just this curiosity in Kabbalistic realms and mystical things, but really to know how it impacts on our lives. So how it's true, we'll find out when Eliyahu HaNavi comes. You know, all those things will be solved. But that's a very important thing to think about, something I try to point out often, and I have to find the source. It's in the Rambam, where he talks about how two different hashkafic opinions can be held at the same time. But the Kos Eliyahu on the Seder table symbolizes that. So the Kos Eliyahu, you know, we have four cups that we drink at the Seder table, connected to the Arba Lashonot Geula, right? But really, there's Chamesh Lashonot Geula.
Right.
Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. V'ga'alti v'lakachti v'heveti. Those are the five, right? V'heveti. So we drink four, connect the first four, because they already happened. But the fifth one, v'heveti, into the land of Israel, and helps you set up shop there permanently, that's the paraphrase of the pasuk, right, didn't happen yet. Because the heveti into the land the first time was not the heveti that it was talking about. It's talking about what's still to come when we all go into the land again and it's a permanent settlement in the land. So that Heveti hasn't happened yet. So the question is, what do we do with that? You know, we drink four cups, connected the first four, but should we have a fifth cup, connected the fifth, or not? So we lost the halacha.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what to do. So what we do is we pour the fifth cup, but we don't drink it. And that's the cup we put in the middle of our table. Poured, but not drunk from, and we call that the Kos Eliyahu, not because Eliyahu comes and drinks from it, unlike what we learn as children, but rather because it's a shaila, and Eliyahu will answer those shailas when he comes in the end of days. It's not that the answer is unknowable, it's just not known by us. The answer
mm-hmm.
is known, and Eliyahu is going to answer all those questions. So it's a very interesting thing to think about, that at the center of our Seder table is a cup of question marks. So right in the moment, the pinnacle of the year when we're passing on our Masorah to the next generation, at the center of the table is a question mark. And we say, there's a lot we know, but there is some stuff we don't. And that, we could live with the question. We don't die from Akasha. I know that's a Yiddish phrase, I don't know how to say it in Yiddish, but we don't die from Akasha. So we don't die from Akasha. We have Akasha in the middle of the table, and we're going to find out. But meanwhile, we're still going to live as Jews, right? So you could have a shaila on something and live with it for generations. It's okay. So, and especially with hashkafa, we don't always know what's exactly right, but we learn it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're allowed to pick what we believe among the believable opinions of reliable chachamim. So if you go by Rambam and Ramban, they both have different opinions on a bunch of different things. You're allowed to pick which one you like best and believe that one.
Mm-hmm.
or wonder about both. That's permitted. Halacha, you can't do that, of course, because you have to be able to behave in one way or the other. You can't both eat rice and not eat rice on Pesach. Right? You have to pick one. Among other things. So the point is, with Negel Vasser, so that is Negel Vasser in the middle of the night, so that would be a reflection of Hashkafa. So one should ask their rabbinic authority what their halacha is, how they behave. How do they walk that path? I think there's probably a few different ways. For me personally, now that I've learned more about the level of tumah that could be there, I personally try to be makpid to wash. And I do, even if I just get up to go to the bathroom, I wash Negel Vasser first in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Now that I understand this level of tumah that's there, the level of tumah that I don't want to stick or interact with other parts of myself. So, okay, any other thoughts or questions?
No.
Mom did that. Okay, so I think we should end here just because that's the end of this chapter.
Okay.
Then we get into even more esoteric stuff, the next chapter being theurgy. It's not really a word in English as far as I know, but I mean, that's sort of like phylacteries, you know? It's not really a word in English, but it's the word that we use in English to mean something. So we'll look at that next, and that gets a little bit more esoteric. But here we're just going to review 5 levels of the soul, a few extra portions of the soul that can come and go on Yom Tov and Shabbos. The upper 4 levels of the soul can have their bonds loosened while we sleep and go to different spiritual areas. They can go as far or as close as our physical activities of the day allow them to go at night. And they can bring back information. If they're bringing back information from positive places, that can show up in dreams as true information. If they're bringing back information from negative places, that can show up in dreams as untrue information. Even if we have true information, and even if it's a lot of it, we'll still for sure be mixed with other parts of our imagination in dreams. We don't have prophetic dreams. A prophetic dream is different than this kind of dream that can have pieces mixed into it. I think that's the main thing. So the animal soul is called the nefesh, the human soul is called the neshama, and the lowest level is the nefesh, all connected in the blood, and that's how it attaches to our body. I think that's basically the review of this chapter. So any questions on any of those things, or that all seems pretty clear?
No, it's pretty clear.
Okay, great. Perfect. So we'll meet again next week. Bezrat Hashem.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.